Good morning.
Good morning.
It's a pleasure to be here again. I said that what I wanted to talk about was a life of offering. And I started reading and preparing, and I was overwhelmed by the richness of what our tradition has to offer. So I will just... I chose one main text to talk from. I'm going to ask if anyone is new, if I use a word that you don't understand or a name, please just wave at me so that I can explain it. Are any people kind of new, newish? Okay, so I'll keep that in mind. And thank you for coming on this beautiful summer day. So our school was founded by a man named Dogen, a young man in Japan who went to China. Well, first he became a monk in his teens, was very enthusiastic, always wanted more and more, and finally he persuaded his teacher to go to China. Traveled all over the place looking for a true teacher. And had just about given up, and then finally somebody said, go over there. He spent 2 years with that teacher, felt that he had received what he needed to receive, and came back and attempted to teach. Had a little difficulty at first. And he started writing before he was actually settled in a temple and teaching. But the text that I'm going to talk about is sort of midway in his actual teaching career. It's called The Bodhisattva's Four Methods of Guidance. Now, bodhisattva is the word in our tradition for the person who has made a commitment not only to live the spiritual life, the life of commitment, but to live that in a way that embraces everyone around us and the whole universe, as opposed to just, say, achieving some kind of internal mental state or feeling personally happy. We don't think you can feel happy if people around you are all miserable and you're not involved with them. Of course, the people around us, many of them are miserable. So this brings us to these four methods of guidance. Another translation is the four all-embracing actions, which it's a little more equal. You know, guidance sounds like you're the teacher, but these are for all of us. These are not just for special people. So I'll read some, but I won't read all. The Bodhisattva's four methods of guidance are giving, kind speech, beneficial action, and identity action. Now, most of these are pretty simple. I'm really only going to talk about giving, but kind speech is kind speech. Speaking with kindness. Beneficial action is action that is helpful to others. Identity action is the one that might need explanation, and that is when you do an action, you understand that you're not separate from the other party involved in the action. Like, I might understand that even though it looks like you and I are completely different human beings and we haven't met, we are still not separate from each other. And so it's like relating to people and other beings and the whole world on that level in which we are one, without pretending that we don't have separate lives and experiences. So So this defines how we're going to relate to everything around us. And specifically giving, I'm going to read some and comment as I go along. Giving means non-greed. That wasn't obvious. I would have thought that giving meant, you know, to give something. Non-greed means not to covet. Not to covet means not to curry favor. Okay, even if you govern the four continents, as in the whole world, you should always convey the correct teaching with non-greed. Okay. So if I'm speaking here hoping that you'll think I'm a great speaker, which of course I do, that's greed. Some places I speak and I'm paid by donations from individuals, which of course stirs up greed. Here they just give me a fee and you give the temple. So it's straightforward. And I often speak and receive no money because conveying the correct teaching is not about receiving something for myself, whether that be money, physical possessions, or, status or fame. Okay, now, it is to give away unneeded belongings to someone you don't know. Anybody ever done that? You give to Goodwill, you post things on FreeCycle. We do that all the time. So that kind of action, because he says unneeded belongings, that kind of action is part of this practice of giving. To offer flowers blooming on a distant mountain to the Tathagata, the Buddha. To offer flowers blooming on a distant mountain, so you didn't cut the flowers and put them on the altar. How did you offer those flowers that you didn't even touch and maybe you never saw? How does the life of giving include things that we don't see or touch, giving them to someone that we don't see or touch? Ooh, this is just, it's sort of like getting interesting, and I'm not going to answer that. And then we have, or again, to offer treasures you had in your former life to sentient beings. Sentient beings is anybody who's conscious, not restricted to humans. So he's saying you can give things that you don't have. Giving is not about possession. The idea of giving takes us into a world in which we don't have property. Well, or at least you can give things that are not your property. Whether it is of teaching or material, each gift has its value and is worth giving. So in the old traditions, lay people would give material objects and monks and nuns would give teachings. And there was a sort of exchange feeling about it, although it was really important that you weren't allowed to, you weren't supposed to give the teaching for the purpose of getting breakfast. Actually, I have a friend who moved to Cambodia, and she observed that the monks there never went to preach at poor people's houses. And she started a project. All the people involved in a project were poor people. She's not exactly wealthy herself. But that's, it's like you can feel the ickiness of that. So this is like, even if the gift is not your own, there is no reason to keep from giving. I don't think this means take something from the store and hand it to somebody on the street. I think we're in this realm of what what does it mean? How do we live life where the nature is giving rather than buying and selling? We live in a culture that's very oriented towards buying and selling. And it's during the course of my life, it's gotten much more so. When I grew up, at least within the church or the churches, it was sort of more about, you know, giving. And as a child, I was kind of proud that my parents, although they had good money, they did not have a cabin or a boat or any of that stuff. They supported the church. And that was where I found pride, because they raised me with values like that that I found again when I came to Buddhism. That the nature, so there's the nature of happiness. There's been research on happiness recently. Someone even wrote a book, which of course I could not find when I wanted to refer to it. But what they determined, they did studies of happiness, and since I, you know, how do you determine whether somebody's happy? You ask them various things. That money doesn't make happiness except in two situations. The one situation is up to about $10,000 a year, more money makes more happiness. I think, and that number actually remained stable during some periods of inflation. But I can't tell you if it's now still 10,000 or maybe it's 11,000, and it would depend what state you are in and how much the rent is and things like that. But so having the necessities of life at a basic level, not a dishwasher or even maybe a car, but having food and shelter does make people happier. And at the other end, the people where money was determined to have a relation to happiness was for people who gave it away. And it made them more happy if they gave it away in a personal manner than if they just, you know, made an online donation. So that's how money makes happiness. You have your basic needs. And so one of my little practices, and it's especially when I come to clouds, I keep dollar bills in my car where I can access them. There's a corner I always drive by coming off of the freeway, and there are almost always people panhandling there. And I roll down my window and hand a dollar to whoever's there. And they say thank you, and we smile at each other. You know, a dollar isn't very much. People have said I should increase it, but then I couldn't have as many interactions with people. Because the other thing, the thing I've heard about homeless people is worse than food and money is the way people walk by you without looking at you. And so one of the things, one of my happiness practices is that if I'm walking down a street, I look at people. And I smile at them if I can. And the places where this actually works is not in the suburbs, but in the inner city, where people smile back at me. So, okay. Each gift has its value and is worth giving. Even if the gift is not your own, there's no reason to keep from giving. The question is not whether the gift is valuable, but whether there is merit. There's a story in our tradition of a little boy who offered a handful of sand to the Buddha. That was what he had. The Christians have the story of the widow's mites. We have that little boy with sand and quite a few other things. And this child later became King Ashoka, who, need to tell you, right? So King Ashoka, well, first he was a great king. He conquered the whole world as they knew it. And then he converted to Buddhism, and he spent the rest of his life offering charity, building temples, building stupas to honor the Buddha, and basically giving things away. And by the end of his life, The people around him were controlling him so that he wouldn't give away all the wealth of the kingdom. And so then there's a story where, I don't know, a monk came by, I suppose, and the only thing he had was the mango that he was eating, so he gave it to the monk. This is a person who knew the happiness of giving. All those people he killed while conquering the world, they never talk about that. You know, he might have been making up for something. We don't know. But I'm remembering a long time ago when I was in college and I was involved with a campus ministry and was taken various interesting places. And I met a man, a minister, who was really, really, really happy. He was like, he struck me as the happiest person I had ever met. He ran a homeless shelter. He had homeless people sleeping in his bedroom. That, I mean, like extreme giving. And what I saw in him was happiness. And I think I thought about that for a long time. I remember trying to tell someone about it who couldn't understand, but of course they hadn't met him and I wasn't radiating like that. So just talking about it doesn't work so well. Okay. Buddha said, when a person who practices giving goes to an assembly, people take notice. You should know that the mind of such a person communicates subtly with others. Therefore, give even a phrase or verse of the truth. It will be a wholesome seed for this and other lifetimes. Give your valuables, even a penny or a blade of grass. It will be a wholesome root for this and other lifetimes. The truth can turn into valuables. Valuables can turn into the truth. This is all because the giver is willing. Not only should you make an effort to give, but be mindful of every opportunity to give. You were born into this present life because of the merit of giving in this past. So, you know, we go through life and our experience depends on how we meet those around us. I think that wasn't quite a self-evident statement. I have certainly many times either welcomed guests or dealt with people on the street and been really irritated at what they were trying to get from me, or irritated at how foolish they were. Right now I'm irritated at our government. And I heard about those children sleeping on the cement floors without soap or showers or outdoor. And I was like, oh my gosh. It's like, oh. So I think I heard about that last night. I don't know how I can give in this situation. A lot of times when I don't know what to do, I put the name on my altar and I chant for whoever it is. And maybe I'll add those children to the list of chanting. There's a man that I know slightly in Northfield who was at the hospital again. He shouldn't be in his house, you know. He should be in a supported living and he doesn't want to go. And so they're trying to get people more phone numbers so that he doesn't always call the same few people when he needs a ride to the hospital. I put his name on my altar. And I'm closer, so it's like, okay, does he get my phone number? The odds of my being available to give a ride? I haven't decided yet. The life of giving, I've met people who just always say yes. I haven't quite become one. I'm studying it still. So Okay. I want to mention the meal chant. How many people have been to Oryoki meals here and done those chants? So the very first time I went to a retreat and chanted the meal chant, I was so excited about it that I memorized it secretly, because you're not supposed to read. But I was sneaking during breaks, look at the chant book and get this. It was a different translation. I like it better. So I'm going to talk about that one, because it's sort of it shapes our world. Innumerable labors have brought us this food. We should know how it comes to us. Suppose the food is a tomato that I grew in my garden. And suppose even that I planted the seed and grew it from scratch, which I didn't. So there are not farm workers, there are not, truckers, there are not grocery stores. That whole chain of human involvement, if you take that out, which is usually involved with our food, you have a seed that has life in it. You have soil that is full of life, microbes, fungi, nutrients. You have their interaction. You have rain that falls, unless I watered it. Right now we're having a lot of rain. So you have all these things coming together to make this bit of food. And so the next line says, as we receive this offering, we should consider whether our virtue and practice deserve it. And I'm just going to say, there is no way. We can never deserve that food. We can never earn it. And so the mythology that if you go to a job, are paid in money, go to the store and hand over money in exchange for food, the mythology that we earn our daily bread is just that. It's a picture of how the world works that is sort of the opposite of the picture that's helping me to be more alive, that I'm trying to talk about today. And then it says, as we desire the natural condition of mind to be free from suffering, to be free from clinging, we must be free from greed. See, I wrote it down from my memory and I made a mistake. To be free from clinging, the natural condition of mind is not clinging. The natural condition of mind is open and relaxed. And then it says, to support our life, we take this food. Yes. To attain the Buddha way, we take this food. So to be able to practice and to be able to live the holy life, we need to eat this food. But that's the part that's for us. This food is for the three treasures, for our parents, teachers, leaders, and homeland, meaning everybody. Our parents gave us life, raised us, fed us, and got us here. Teachers gave us the Dharma, still do, probably. Leaders, maybe we like our leaders and maybe we don't. And homeland, and for all beings in the six worlds. So when we receive something, we receive it on behalf of everything. When we chant, we say, in Buddhism, we say that we create merit, and thus we have to give it away. You can't have merit by yourself. It's just like, who would want to? Who would want to be alone? I was remembering a television show in the late 50s, and I decided it was Leave It to Beaver, and the teenage boy, I had to look it up, actually. But the teenage boy is envious of a friend of his who has lots of money and spends it all on himself. So his father, who is the wise sage, says, all right, I'll give you an allowance of $10 a week, but you can't spend it on anyone else. So he takes his $10 and he's buying ice cream and eating whatever, and his friends say, "Hey, can I have some?" And he says, "No." He gets over it pretty quickly. Friends are so much more important than stuff. And then I have a story about that eating thing. We eat this food with everyone. I'm going to finish it first. We eat this food with everyone. We eat to end all evil, to cultivate good, to save all sentient beings, and to practice the Buddha way, to accomplish the Buddha way. Just eating, just everything, anytime we receive something, it's a way of being part of the entire universe, which is always giving and receiving. It's creating, it's nourishing, we are creating, we are nourishing. So here's the story, and how much, okay, I have time. Martin Prechtel, he lived in Guatemala in a traditional Mayan village for 10 years and became their shaman. He was recruited, he was drafted, it wasn't his idea. But somewhere during that time, there was an earthquake. And he heard that, there was disaster, there was starvation. And he wanted to do something about it, and he thought he should bring some food. And I will skip the very long story of his attempt to raise money, which didn't work so well, but he got some volunteers, which he refers to as hippies, and they had some old trucks, which broke down a lot. And they did get a little money, and they bought, on credit, he says, 3/4 of a ton of black beans, 1.5 tons of white coastal rice, 8 cleaned-out topless oil barrows, and a bird. Okay. He says, a beautiful male chachalaca bird who had secretly fallen in love with one of the truck beds. On the way up, he's a poet. So it takes a long time to read his stuff. So they went back to, I think they went to his village. But anyway, so they cooked this stuff in the cleaned out oil barrels, firewood. An extra 5 gallons of gasoline for these multiple trucks. And they would cook one day. And there were 6 or 7 of them, and they would load up early in the morning and head out along the roads. And they kept getting to other villages. They wanted to go to Kuchumakik for some reason. And so they gave away the food and came back and cooked more food. Finally they actually got to Kuchumakik. There are stories. They were scared. There was a man hanging as they were reading. It was not possible for them to turn around because they were scared by this. It was totally not expected. Anyway, they got to Kuchumakik. Somebody came towards them to say, "Come here, it's this way." He won't bother you. He came here to sell us blankets and food that the Red Cross was giving away free in Chimaltenango in trade for our farmland. Of course, they had to hang him. Anyway, so they get to Kuchumakik. There are thousands of people there. Let me see. With supplies in such desperate scarcity, we neared this great crowd of starving families, fully expecting to be mobbed by a horde of hunger-crazed people pushing us out of the way, while the strongest individuals elbowed and clubbed their way to get closer to the precious sustenance of the cooked seeds. In the same way, I'd seen tragic masses of waving, hunger-driven arms and bodies besieging vehicles and food deliveries in more citified areas, and in some cases seriously injuring or even killing one another or those handing out the food. All of us in the back of the truck concurred that we should all leap away from the bed and get as far away as we could if it came to that, and then wait until we could reclaim the truck and return. But in that anxious moment of entering what had been Kuchumakik, there were no desperate people running, nor a happily cheering crowd, only the low bee-like hum of the murmur of small clusters of sitting humans, equally mixed with the little sounds of equally hungry yellow warblers twittering in the dead branches of uprooted trees. So they drove in. Okay, hundreds of sitting people, 70 family groups, who had not had anything to eat for days. And he makes an announcement. He apologizes. There's more food. And he says, a momentary silence landed over our settling dust as everybody looked back at us with 600 tired, sweet eyes. I'm sorry. I exaggerate. It was not thousands. Then from every side, in an instant of parallel motion characteristic of a communal mind, an individual man or woman representing their hungry family, their wounded, their young, their old, came gracefully to their feet, each man removing his hat if he still had one, the women with their hands waving to the rhythm of the poetry. What they spoke was not a response to us, but to that divine thing that lived in all mother seeds, like the beans and rice that fed us all, and thereby made us live with the death of her cooked seeds. They simultaneously prayed for this in a fine old spoken kachikel, adding as well that our families and ourselves be blessed and kept from harm, and that we be able to find in our visit to their proud people a welcome worthy of the effort we'd made to get here. They had not come together to have a better chance at survival, but rather to die together at the will of nature, which is the Holy's mind, living together peacefully while they waited. They did not see the food we brought as something to save them, but as a gift from people outside their area who had themselves come to Kuchumakik in hopes of being given permission to remain with these proud Mayans and live out our remaining days of the world's end together. Kuchumakik was a sacred place considered to be the origin of their people. And that's why five different villages had all migrated there when the end of the world seemed to happen. They wanted the symphony of their thousand-year struggle to live in the arms of the corn seeds, earth, to end here where it had begun, at the place of their mutual origins. In this way, they themselves would become spiritual seeds, and their passing become temporal humus from which the divine could regrow a world beyond their own time. So they knew they were sure they were going to die, that they were going to starve to death. And so it happens, the men gave their hats to the senior lady in each family group, and then they came elegantly and orderly to hold up the hat into which these guys dropped a ladle of cooked black beans and a ladle of warm rice. They thanked them, they smiled, they went back. Each woman returned to her patiently waiting family. Because the earthquake had pulverized or buried all the bowls and receptacles, these hats were commandeered for today's communal eating dishes. In the most calm and unfrantic elegance, the people fed one another as if it had always been this way. Three more truckloads would have been necessary to remotely resemble one meal for every person there. There was a lot of suffering, but in some strange way, there were no victims. Everyone was given equally. And these guys stood staring amazingly. And then they were invited. They said, you have to come and eat with us. And Martin was the only one who accepted because he understood. He says, all foods in their live forms are the bodies of the divine. To refuse the bigness of the offer of even the smallest particle of one plant's or one mineral's holy death from a friend was an ignorance that implied a superiority over the whole in nature and constituted a condescension to the people and in the end a kind of spiritual violence that not only wounded the grandeur and pride of the indigenous heart, but worse yet, insulted the divine bigness of nature's depth itself. And so he accepted food, and he says he did what he noticed the other young men were doing, which was to take a little tiny bit and then sneak the rest of it to somebody who needed it more. But the receiving, to not receive this kind of gift, it was a form of stinginess and greed. Instead of feeding the hungry, we would be stealing their capacity to give the greatness of the gift, of this comprehension, back to the gift givers. By refusing, we would be impoverishing the nobility of the people we came to feed. I took a walk once with Claude Anshin Thomas along the Texas, the U.S.-Mexico border, and we mostly, and the rules were carry no money, no cell phones, and totally rely on the people around us. And so here we were, and we had, I mean, none of us were desperately poor anyway. And we were asking for food from people who were quite poor, some of them. And so we had a conversation about what it meant that we asked them for food. And the best answer we had then was from Bill, who you don't know, who said, you know, we're trusting ourselves to them. We have reversed the power imbalance. I think we were all white, and most of them were Latino, with the occasional person of various other colors. And a lot of people didn't speak English, and we only had one Spanish speaker. So it was sort of pathetic, you know. It's like, oh, here we are. What right do we have to be here? And then we're asking them to give us food. But what Martine talked about here is really it, you know. I mean, he had food at home. And as he said, he and the people with him, they were not living on the edge of starvation. And they were bringing food to people who were definitely on the edge of starvation and who had lived that way all their lives, too, you know. You're out in a village, and it all depends on whether the harvest comes in, whether you'll have food to eat. And so people who depend on the natural world in that way know something that people who depend on grocery stores and money don't know. And people who live in the city but are on the edge of starvation, I don't even know. It's like, oh, I just, you know, I'm talking, and so of course they come into my mind. But to know uncertainty. It's like we are now, these days, having it pushed in our face. How many people live with uncertainty, and for how many of them it's because of what's referred to as our government and corporations and so forth. And we're seeing suffering, and we don't know what to do. I don't know what to do. Dogen says, King Ashoka was able to offer enough food for hundreds of monks with half a mango. I think he made that up. To give to yourself is part of giving. To give to your family is also giving. Even when you give a particle of dust, you should rejoice in your own act. Because you correctly transmit the merit of all Buddhas. And for the first time, practice is an act of a bodhisattva. The mind of a sentient being is difficult to change. You should keep on changing the minds of sentient beings from the first moment that they have one particle to the moment they attain the way. This should be started by giving. For this reason, giving is the first of the six paramitas. And I just realized Martine said, he talked about what this did to him. Can I find it? I can't find it. Should have marked it. He never forgot. This is like so maybe I'm drawn to this story because of climate change and because I'm really aware. I'm like, food prices are going to be high this fall. I don't know if they are yet, probably. But we're on the cusp of seeing hunger in our country. And for some of us, it's, oh, cut back luxuries. And for some people, it's like, where's the food? I remember in 2008 in Bloomington, Indiana, I used to go to the food shelf. It was called Mother Hubbard's Cupboard, and it was a place of generosity and abundance. And then there was an economic crash, and the lines at that food shelf were so long. And so, because I knew those people had less than I did, but I couldn't stand to stay away, I would go at the end of the day. Or at the end of the two-hour period that they were open. But it just amazed me to see how many people in a relatively comfortable place need food. We're in a time like that. We're coming into a time like that. And how do we respond? How do we find giving? How do we find giving? It's like, oh, no, I don't have the answer. I'm doing things. I do chanting. I'm growing food with the intention of being able to give it away when that's needed. I'm not even close. And I'm trying to study, trying to learn from the land as I moved to the country so I could do this, trying to get a sense of that generosity and that gift, which he writes about a lot more than what I read, but that sense, innumerable labors have brought us this food. Everyone is feeding us. Everyone is feeding us. They're also feeding each other. And I think that understanding that everyone is feeding us is the first step. And I'm still working on the first step. And while I'm working on it, I'm making an effort to teach it. I have to make a plug for the retreat. the second weekend in August, it's called the Land Care Retreat, but the point is to sit some zazen and to study our relationship to the physical world around us through giving to it and listening to it. And my teacher is going to show up and give one talk. So, and there are flyers out there. But, okay. So I had to do this, but this is, it's like, oh my gosh. When I first went to Green Gulch Farm, San Francisco Zen Center, sometime in my first year, my teacher said to me, you should study giving. And all my friends said, what? You should not give. You should, you need to accept more. And so I went back to my teacher and clarified, and then it made more sense. It's like, you know, it's not like I have stuff, so I'm going to give it to you. It's like all of our relationships are giving and receiving and giving and receiving. And when you receive, you're giving. And when you give, you're receiving miracles. And sitting zazen helps us to be available to that. But that's what I want to say. Does anyone have questions or comments? Yes.
Yeah, I came up in a Reformed Jewish tradition by default of the marriage. We raised our kids as Jews, just so they'd have a rather pure experience of a tradition that they can then accept or develop,
yeah,
or not as they see fit once they reach adulthood. But so I was pretty involved in the life of the temple and got really close to the rabbi, Gary Gerson, is his name. He and I got along really well, even though I was raised a Lutheran.
Mm-hmm.
And he's very, very much culturally and psychologically Jewish. But we really hit it off, kind of like Mutt and Jeff. And you know, we both have a pretty active life of the mind. Gary is phenomenally intellectually talented, open, receptive. Master's thesis in the seminary in Cincinnati was had a title something along the lines of Kant's ontology of being in the Tanakh, which is the wisdom books of the of the Jewish Hebrew scriptures. So this is no intellectual life. I remember sitting in a discussion group with him one day, and another congregant asked, if you could sum up the essence of Judaism in one or two sentences, if that's possible, what would it be? And he thought for a moment. He said, every day when you get up in the morning, be prepared to do a good deed for another person. He looked at him, this intellectual giant. He said, that's it? He said, yeah. He said, do mitzvot, which is Hebrew for good deeds. Mm-hmm. That's it. Just do good deeds.
Mm-hmm.
Next question? And I've never committed myself formally to Judaism, which Gary respected quite a bit, so that is having integrity. But I have committed myself formally to Buddhism, and the more I sit zazen, and not to beat the drum for zazen as some kind of a cure-all, it ain't. But the more I become closer to my own felt awareness of just being in the world and being with others, out of that experience of first being with myself in a non-manipulative, non-exploitative, non-objectifying way, I can more and more feel, as opposed to understand intellectually, but I can now feel the wisdom of Gary's words and your speech from a very different tradition is essentially echoing that.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wanted to thank you for that.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for the story. Mm-hmm. Yes.
I had a memory that came to me as you were speaking about smiling at or kind of looking at people on the street, which is back at the old Clouds and Water downtown.
Oh, yes.
I had been sitting a lot in the mornings, and I went through a couple of, the old service and chanting, and I came out and I'm walking to where the car was, and a complete stranger comes up and smiles at me. And then I smiled at him and said, good morning. But it was like, The Zazen must have made me receptive enough to have this interaction. It happens sometimes now. It doesn't always happen.
Mm-hmm.
It is a wonderful feeling of just mutuality with a stranger who's not really a stranger because we're both humans.
Yeah. I thank you. I find that too. It's like the more I sit, I mean, it was sitting that broke open the shell in the first place. But I need to keep it up, and it keeps that up. Yes?
The most memorable part of your talk is when you tell the story of these starving people and they were waiting for their death.
Yeah.
And preparing to be part of the humans of the earth.
Mm-hmm.
And I started thinking, I was really struck spiritually by that. And that's really what when you say that giving it at the end, being connected to everything, that at the end of the day, no matter this brain that I have, you can have PhDs, you can have lots of money, you can be billionaires. At the end of the day, your body becomes. becomes food for the bacteria that enriches the earth. That's it.
Yeah, if you allow
it. That's the reality and the absolute truth of our existence.
Right.
That we are part of that whole. When zillions of atoms started to spew and reconnect, at the end of the day, that's what they do. Mass is destroyed, is created, mass energy, and we are part of it. We can never be separate from it.
Thank you. Beautiful. Oops, okay, Ron, and you.
I was going to thank you. Thank you for a wonderful talk about giving that to us. I was really, you had a phrase early on that I really, that I was thinking about a lot, in which you said that something, I'm paraphrasing, and if you could comment a little more about it, it would be great, that clinging is not a natural state of mind.
Yes.
So I was thinking about that as it is a learned behavior. It isn't something that we need to just excuse as being just a natural human thing. And so I'm really contemplating that more. And can you talk a little bit about that?
You'll have to put a time limit on me. So the story, the current mythology of our culture, Christianity contributed to this, but I'm not going to blame it on them, is that humans are basically selfish and evil, and that we have to be civilized in order to be made nice and decent, and that what we always want is to have stuff for ourselves. And, you know, anybody who's lived in a family or, say, raised a child or something, deep down understands that that's not true. But we don't believe our own experience. We believe what we're told. So one of the tidbits of research that's useful is somebody did DNA checks. So there's chimpanzees and bonobos. And people are talking about chimpanzees as the model for humans. You know, they're and they have hierarchical structures. They have alpha males and alpha females. And, you know, so we think that's our nature. It turns out that we are more like bonobos. Bonobos are another ape. They're a little smaller. They are not hierarchical. They are not violent. They spend a lot of time grooming each other. And if there's ever conflict, I'm sorry, they resolve it by sex. And I remember, but the other fact is, it wasn't chimpanzees, gorillas. Another ape group of the hierarchical kind had a curious incident. They were living near a village, and some of them would go and raid the dumpsters for easy food. The dumpsters got poisoned somehow. So all the apes that were raiding the dumpsters died. Well, it turns out those were the alphas. So you have this group that's, you know, has always been hierarchical, but all those characters are gone. They became egalitarian. And not only that, but when they said it was alpha males who were raiding, but I would want to double check that. But of course, to survive, you have to bring in others from outside your village. Well, they trained them. So they trained them into being like themselves. So a group that was thought to be like genetically disposed to violence and hierarchy, it turned out they could be changed. Let me see. Now, I may have gotten off of your question. Okay, that's sufficient. Yes?
Is giving self-gratification?
Is it?
I'm asking you.
Okay. Is giving self-gratification? I would say it's possible that is giving with greed and clinging. When Dogen said, giving means non-greed, that means you're not giving for the sole purpose of making yourself feel better.
Then you should be smiling.
I knew there was going to be a trick. However, giving automatically produces feeling better.
You're avoiding the question.
Okay, start again. Is giving self-gratification? Okay, so is the basic meaning of giving self-gratification? No, that's not its definition. And according to Dogen's definition, if you're giving for the purpose of making yourself feel better, that wouldn't qualify in his definition of giving.
Can I formulate a brief response to that?
Sure, go ahead.
I would say that it's a setting up a false conflict, it's a false antinomy. You know, when I give to myself, when I receive for myself, my roommate just gave me $100 so I could go to Chicago. Ooh. And visit my daughters.
Nice, yeah.
So that was very gratifying to, quote, me, and I put me in quotes because it creates a sense of bondedness and reflects a sense of bondedness between he and I that has always been there and is now deepened.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
By his bold act of, again, challenging the difference between he and I. So where am I and who am I to receive and who am I also then to give? These are essential questions, but I don't think they're best understood by the categories of I and you, us and them. That would be my quick thought.
We can discuss this
yeah.
later on.
Yeah. Time?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you so much. Thank you for your questions.
Closing chat.